the Oscar goes to Jane Campion for the piano.
Jane Campion is the only film director to have won the Palme d'Or for short film and best film, the latter coming in 1993 for her 19th century drama, The Piano. Since then, she has adapted Henry James's The Portrait of a Lady and brought the doomed romance between John Keats and Fanny Brawne to the screen in Bright Star. More recently, she has moved into TV, co-writing and directing the critically acclaimed detective series Top of the Lake. No matter the format, short films or features, cinema or TV, working from her own original material or adapting literary classics, Jane Campion's unique vision has confirmed her as one of the world's great filmmakers. Stephen Benedict joins us now to tell us why. Stephen, what is it about Jane Campion's work that is so distinctive?
I think, like all great artists, Kay, Jane Campion has a preferred set of themes. And like all great filmmakers in particular, what she does is she visualizes those themes in a really, really magnetic way. For me, one of her recurring themes and strongest recurring themes is the collision of sensibilities, you know, the clash of cultures, the way history plays upon the present, the past upon the present, gender, obviously. And then hopefully if we have time, we'll talk about language. And I think all those things sort of come into play most memorably in the opening sequence of The Piano. If you just visualise the opening in the film, we're on a windswept New Zealand beach and this heavy, cumbersome musical instrument is standing there. And it's the juxtaposition of those elements, the wild Antipodean landscape with an object of, you know, refined European sensibility. And then on top of that, you've got the roaring waves, which are silencing the piano. The piano's not being played. It should be being played by a woman, but she doesn't speak and she communicates through her 8-year-old daughter. So it's those collisions, it's those clashes and juxtapositions that she visualises brilliantly in her films.
Yeah, they are arresting images, all right, ones that stay with you. And it's interesting that she came relatively late in life to become a filmmaker, an auteur filmmaker at that.
Yeah.
Because there were other influences on her career before she went into filmmaking.
Yeah, it is interesting that both her parents were prominent members of the New Zealand film theatre community. Her father was an established director and her mother was a very, very well-renowned actress. And yet, despite that obvious entree into drama, Jane Campion herself opted to go to college to study anthropology, of all things. Once she'd finished her degree, then she decided, having this background, she decided to go off and study art, painting, and she became quite an accomplished painter. So twice she avoided inheriting this great gift that her parents could have provided for her. But what she found was that when she had graduated from doing her art degree, that she was frustrated by the fact that the canvas wouldn't move. So she annotated her paintings with written words and dialogue and captions. So in order for the image to tell the story as opposed to showing a picture, showing a sort of a frozen moment in time.
And can we see any of those visual artists, fine artists, collage maker in her work?
Yes. You know, you can see definitely the Mexican genius Frida Kahlo. And she herself specialised in the collision of sensibilities because, I mean, you're talking in your earlier writing, we're talking about magic realism. She fused realism and fantasy on her canvases. And so if you transfer that into the work of Jane Campion from her very, very short films, before she became a feature filmmaker, as you said, she won the Palme d'Or for the short film at the Cannes Film Festival with a film called Peel. And on the surface, that's a very, very simple story. It's about a father and his two children on a road trip. But it's complicated by, of all things, the son who's peeling an orange and throwing the skin out onto the road. And so you can just juxtapose the tar, you know, the black tar, the tarmac, with the orange peel. And it's that sensibility, that tension that Campion creates. You can see that in her first feature film, Sweetie, which was also screened, was invited to screen in competition at the Cannes Film Festival. There's a sequence, it's about a young woman called Sweetie, and she has these very, very vivid dreams. And one of them is of a tree bursting up through the slabs in the family's back patio. And then in her second film, which is a very, very important film, it's called An Angel at My Table. You know, the forest at night, there's a scene set at night in the forest, and it looks strange, because all of a sudden these young children start to dance around in it, and because they're wearing crowns and tiaras and they've given themselves wings, it's transformed into a fairy tale landscape. So those juxtapositions run all the way through her work.
A little bit like what we were talking about with Jane Carson, yes, about that magic realism. So given that she is a groundbreaking director and that her work tends to centre on women, she's reluctant then to be described as a feminist filmmaker.
Yeah. You know, that's a funny one, and it's a tough one. I think the reason why she's reluctant to fully embrace that title is because all too often what happens then, it brings a very, very limiting question, which is, what's it like to be a female director? And she says repeatedly, you know, no man has ever asked that question. What's it like to be a male director? And so, as you mentioned, she won the Palme d'Or at the Cannes Film Festival, the first woman to become the winner of the Palme d'Or. And while, you know, she... when she's asked that, when it's mentioned to her, she deflects that historical achievement very, very quickly as a regrettable fact, because to this day, she says she's the only woman who has ever won the Palme d'Or. She's not the first. She's still the only woman. And she regrets that. That win makes her unique. She'd much prefer to share that pedestal with many, many other women. And I think when she's categorised as a feminist filmmaker, it sort of ring fences her the questions and therefore limits her answers, because we understand, you know, feminism strides for equity and equality, but what Jane Campion wants to do is to break the conversation out of that very, very restrictive confine of, oh, you're a woman director, isn't that an oddity?
Yeah, yeah. So you said there earlier that you'd like to talk about language in her work.
Yeah.
And it's interesting that one of her most famous films, The Piano, which did win her the Palme d'Or, that the central character, Ada McGrath, played by Holly Hunter, yeah, and she won the Oscar for that. She is silent. She's mute throughout the film.
Yeah, but here's the crucial thing. Ada can speak, but she just chooses not to. You know, we hear at the very beginning, we hear an inner monologue as a voiceover. And then we learn that she chose to stop speaking at the age of 6. And that's a very, very conscious decision on Campion's part to place this decision on Ada. Because by refusing to speak, Ada symbolically is stepping outside of a society that metaphorically silences her.
And Stephen, maybe you'd just tell us a little bit about The Piano. Just recall it for us a little.
Okay, well, it's set in the 19th century. It's set in New Zealand. And Ada plays a woman who's been, she's literally a mail order bride. And she's been sent from Scotland with her daughter. It's never explained whether she was married before. It's never explained, did her husband die? And so she arrives in New Zealand, and she's there to be married to a guy called Stuart, played by Sam Neill. And Stuart is, he's a colonialist, and he owns vast tracts of land, which means that the colonisation of New Zealand is a very important metaphor in the film as well, because the Maori people, the indigenous population, are subjected to the same restrictions and oppressions that he's meeting out to Ada, because they can't, you know, English is not their first language, and yet they're supposed to speak the man's language, which is spoken by Stuart. And so when she arrives on the beach, she refuses to part with her piano. It's too cumbersome and too troublesome for Stuart to bring the piano across this really, really hilly landscape to their house. So he decides to leave it there. There's a third character called Baines, which is played by Harvey Keitel, and he takes the piano. And then what he does, he's fascinated with this idea of this woman who won't speak, but she has the gift for to playing the piano. He wants to hear her play the piano. And then he starts to barter with her. She can have her piano back if she plays. And then it becomes very, very complicated and complex, because there's this sexual tension between them. And how that is played out is, you know, contentious for some contemporary audiences. But I think it's a really, really interesting, really, really interesting example of how a filmmaker can re-examine erotica.
And then, is her withholding her own language, her own power of speech, is that some way of retaining some kind of power, even though she's stuck in this awful situation?
Oh, definitely. I mean, you know, she does have agency, because she refuses to partake in the language that is spoken by the men, and it's not her language. And so what she does is she uses sign language, and then she communicates with her daughter. And so her daughter becomes much more vocal in the way children were not supposed to be heard, seen but not heard, this Victorian attitude. And then also she writes down some things that she wants to say, but she refuses to say. So here she is. She's taking writing, which is a domain which has historically been ring-fenced, as I was saying before, for men. She then starts to write, and that's another important point, because it's a theme that Campion returns to later in the movie Bright Star. As you mentioned, it's about John Keats and Fanny Brawne. Fanny Brawne being his fiancée, but also his muse. And Fanny was a woman of great intelligence, but a number of John Keats's contemporaries, especially a struggling poet called Charles Brown, refused to admit or countenance the idea that she could actually read poetry and understand it.
And we have a clip from Bright Star, that very clip you're talking about. In this scene, we hear Charles Brown, Keats's jealous friend, interrogating Fanny Brawne about her reading.
Tell us, what Chaucer did you read?
All of it. Also, Mr. Spencer, Mr. Milton, and the Odyssey.
That's a lot to read in 1 week. What did you think of the Odyssey?
Thank you. I'm yet partway through it. But I've read all Mr. Keats has written.
Have you?
Out went the taper as she hurried in. Its little smoke in pallid moonshine died. She closed the door. She panted, all akin to spirits of the air and visions wide.
And what, Miss Brawne, did you make of Paradise Lost?
Oh, I liked it.
Did you? You didn't find Milton's rhymes a little pouncing?
No.
Oh, he's so condescending, isn't he? Paul Schneider there playing Charles Brown, interrogating Fanny Brawne, and she was played by Abby Cornish.
Yeah, and I think, you know, Kay, what Campion was doing there is she was dramatising sometimes language isn't so much a form of expression, but in the mouths of some people, and as I said, Charles Brown there, language is a means of restriction. Because he wants Fanny to remain quiet, because he thinks it's implausible that a woman would read literature and understand poetry and understand John Keats's poetry. So here what we're seeing is the restrictions of the spoken word, which we saw on the piano, being extended into the written word. And as we know, the written word is how history is gathered and it's mobilised, and then how women are written out and kept silent.
Yeah, because it's so interesting. Fanny is such a wonderful dressmaker, and so her own creativity comes out in how she creates these beautiful costumes for herself. But that's really mocked in the film.
Yes, because it's frivolous and it's fashion, and fashion is modish and it's not classical. It's not going to wait around for a very, very long time. And I think, one of the things that Campion does brilliantly, and she visualises it beautifully in Bright Star, is there's a wonderful scene in Fanny's room where the room is full of butterflies.
Yes, yes.
And it's a beautiful choice of insect because they're so ephemeral and they're so light and the gossamer is there. So it's reflective of the love that she has for Keats and Keats's short life and how delicate his life was and how delicate their relationship was. And again, so that's what I'm saying. She visualises this in these themes in the most arresting of ways.
Yes, women's appearance plays a big role in The Portrait of a Lady, which again tells us so much about Isabel Archer and how her life changes, really.
Yeah, it's adapted from Henry James's Turning Point novel in his career. And you're mentioning Isabel Archer. At the beginning, she's given an opportunity she's a proposal of marriage, which she rejects. And at that stage in the story, she has lovely red, wild and frizzy hair. But when she goes to Florence and she marries Gilbert Osmond, played by the reptilian John Malkovich, she wears her hair in a variety of increasingly restrained braids. I mean, Osmond, as you know, is a relentlessly controlling man, and he conceals his misogyny behind this very, very refined Renaissance aesthetic. And the more control he exerts over Isabel, the greater and more elaborate her hair becomes, until it begins to resemble, you know, one of the sculptures of Osmond's collection. It's almost representative of his tyranny. But then significantly, when she returns to England for her cousin's funeral, her hair is once again free and frizzy. So the hair becomes emblematic. So
Okay, let's hear a clip. This features Isabel Archer, played by Nicole Kidman, and Gilbert Osmond, played by John Malkovich, in which Gilbert humiliates Isabel, striking her on a number of occasions.
Will you tell me in the plainest words of what it is you accuse me?
Of having prevented Pansy's marriage to Warburton. Are those words plain enough?
On the contrary, I took great interest in it. When you told me you counted on me, I accepted the obligation. I was a fool to do so, but I did it.
You pretended to do it. Where is the letter you told me you'd written?
I haven't the least idea.
No, you destroyed it.
Nicole Kidman is Isabel Archer and John Malkovich as Gilbert Osmond there in The Portrait of a Lady. Just in the last few moments, Stephen, what's the importance then of her move into television and Top of the Lake starring Elizabeth Moss?
Well, I think it's fair to say that Jane Campion's most famous and celebrated films are set in the past. And what she's doing with Top of the Lake is she is bringing into play very, very contemporary issues, which are part of the discussion of fourth wave feminism. And so it's not just, it's not just ownership of property. It's not just the ability to write. And it's not just the ability to speak. It's about sexual oppression in the most obscene ways, because it's about, you know, season one is about paedophilia. Mm-hmm. And in season mm-hmm. two, you've got a young girl. She's in school and she's dating a 42-year-old man who's a sex trafficker. And so, again, this brings us back to the anthropological aspect of Campion's background. She's really investigating these disparate cultures and how they clash, and for women and for men, how to navigate them in a safe way to escape that sort of tyranny and that sort of oppression.
Well, that's Top of the Lake, which she's made two series now. Stephen Benedict has been talking to me about the career of New Zealand film director Jane Campion. Stephen, thank you. That's it for tonight's show. The programme was researched by Paula Shields. Mark McGraw was on sound. Janice Furphy was the broadcast coordinator. Tonight's show was produced by Ola McGowan.